This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Yesterday's men failed to save tomorrow.
Telling it like it is. This is the Secretary General of the United Nations. On November 21st, 2021, Antonio Guterres gives his short, stern welcome to delegates at the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland.
Your Royal Highnesses, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, the 6 years since the Paris Climate Agreement have been the 6 hottest years on record. Our addiction to fossil fuels is pushing humanity to the brink. We face a stark choice. Either we stop it or it stops us. And it's time to say enough. Enough of brutalizing biodiversity. Enough of killing ourselves with carbon. Enough of treating nature like a toilet. Enough of burning and drilling and mining our way deeper. We are digging our own graves. Our planet is changing before our eyes, from the ocean depths to mountain tops, from melting glaciers to relentless extreme weather events. Sea level rise is double the rate it was 30 years ago. Oceans are hotter than ever and getting warmer faster. Parts of the Amazon rainforest now emit more carbon than they absorb. Recent climate action announcements might give the impression that we are on track to turn things around. This is an illusion. The last published report on national determined contributions showed that they would still condemn the world to a calamitous 2.7-degree increase. And even if the recent pledges were clear and credible, and there are serious questions about some of them, we are still careening towards climate catastrophe. Even in the best-case scenario, temperatures will rise well above 2 degrees. So, as we open this much-anticipated climate conference, we are still heading for climate disaster. Young people know it. Every country sees it. Small island developing states and other vulnerable ones live it. And for them, failure is not an option. Failure is a death sentence. Excellencies, we face a moment of truth. We are fast approaching tipping points that will trigger escalating feedback loops of global heating. But investing in the net zero climate resilient economy will create feedback loops of its own, virtuous circles of sustainable growth, jobs, and opportunity. We have progress to build upon. A number of countries have made credible commitments to net zero emissions by mid-century. Many have pulled the plug on international financing of coal. Over 700 cities are leading the way to carbon neutrality, and the private sector is waking up. The Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance, the gold standard for credible commitments and transparent targets, is managing $10 trillion in assets and catalyzing change across industries. The Climate Action Army, led by young people, is unstoppable. They are larger, they are louder, and I assure you, they are not going away, and I stand with them. Excellencies, the science is clear. We know what to do. First, we must keep the goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius alive. This requires greater ambition on mitigation and the immediate concrete action to reduce global emissions by 45% by 2030. G20 countries have a particular responsibility as they represent around 80% of emissions. According to the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, in light of national circumstances, developed countries must lead the effort. But emerging economies too must go the extra mile, as their contribution is essential for the effective reduction of emissions. We need maximum ambition from all countries on all fronts to make Glasgow a success. I urge developed countries and the emerging economies to build coalitions to create the financial and technological conditions to accelerate decarbonization of the economy as well as the phase-out of coal. These coalitions are meant to support the large emitters that face more difficulties in the transition from grey to green for them to be able to do it. Let's have no illusions. If commitments fall short by the end of this COP, countries must revisit their national climate plans and policies, not every 5 years, every year, every moment, until keeping to 1.5 degrees is assured, until subsidies to fossil fuels end, until there is a price on carbon, until coal is phased out. But we also need greater clarity. There is a deficit of credibility and a surplus of confusion over emissions reductions and net zero targets with different meanings and different metrics. That is why, beyond the mechanisms already established in the Paris Agreement, I'm announcing today that it will establish a group of experts to propose clear standards to measure and analyze net zero commitments from non-state actors. Second, we must do more to protect vulnerable communities from the clear and present dangers of climate change. Over the last decade, nearly 4 billion people suffered climate-related disasters. That devastation will only grow. But adaptation works. Early warning systems save lives. Climate-smart agriculture and infrastructure save jobs. And all donors must allocate half their climate finance to adaptation. And public and multilateral development banks should start as soon as possible. Third, this COP must be a moment of solidarity. The $100 billion a year climate finance commitment in support of developing countries must become a $100 billion climate finance reality. And this is critical to restoring trust and credibility. I welcome the efforts led by Canada and Germany to help us get there. It is an important first step, but it delays the largest support for years, and it doesn't give clear guarantees. And beyond $100 billion, developing countries need far greater resources to fight COVID-19, to build resilience and pursue sustainable development. Those suffering the most, namely least developed countries and small island developing states, need urgent funding. More public climate finance, more overseas development aid, more grants, easier access to funding. And multilateral development banks must work much more seriously at mobilizing greater investment through blended and private finance. Excellencies, the sirens are sounding. Our planet is talking to us and telling us something. And so are people everywhere. Climate action tops the list of people's concerns across countries, age, and gender. We must listen, and we must act, and we must choose wisely. On behalf of these and future generations, I urge you, choose ambition, choose solidarity, choose to safeguard our future and save humanity, and I thank you.
You know we are fighting off severe climate change when the UN ditches the official baffle gab and talks like that. It was the UN General Secretary of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, opening COP26. As the world as we know it hangs in the balance, there is a galaxy of science, reports, warnings, plans, promises, and protests coming out of Scotland at the climate conference. I'm going to start with the fastest 8-minute briefing ever on the 10 key points you need to understand about what new science is telling us. This is from the esteemed Swedish professor, climate scientist. This is from the esteemed Swedish professor, scientist, and director of the Potsdam Institute, Stefan Rockström, at the COP.
So, I'd like to turn the floor to Professor Jan Rockström to give an overview of the report. Professor Rockström is director of the Potsdam Institute of Climate Impact Research. He represents both Future Earth and Earth League. Over to you, Jan.
Thanks, Wendy, and good morning, everyone. So just to set the report again in stage, I mean, the purpose of this is from the scientific community to hand over the 10 new insights that we believe every climate negotiator must have in his or her back pocket to be an effective negotiator at any COP meeting and certainly here in Glasgow. So this is the scan of the latest insights. Insight number one is that from an Earth system science perspective, we land in the conclusion that 1.5 degrees Celsius is still a possible landing zone. We can still achieve it. The question is, how will we do that from a feasibility perspective? And that an overshoot is likely. It translates to a 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year reduction pace in a linear level. That's 5% per year. But if you want to have a 2/3 chance of success, it requires a doubling to 4 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year, and we emit today 42 gigatons or billion tons of carbon dioxide per year. So here you have the pathways in the report in terms of the landing zone to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Insight number two is what has been very much in discussion here in Glasgow, namely that there is no safe landing to deliver the Paris Agreement only by decarbonizing the global energy system carbon dioxide. Methane, nitrous oxide, the non-CO2 gases are worsening global warming. The climate models show clearly that we need to follow the same pace of reductions as carbon dioxide to have a chance of delivering the Paris Agreement. Here you see the latest assessments of the warming versus cooling gases, and that nitrous oxide and methane are fundamental here, and that the discussions here and agreements is one step along the way, but not sufficient scientifically. Also important in this context is to remind ourselves that air pollutants are actually cooling the planet. So we have a paradox and a very dramatic one, which is that one environmental problem, air pollutants, are camouflaging another environmental crisis, the global warming crisis. And this is well established scientifically. Insight three is that we've entered the age of intensified mega fires. This is also causing, apart from social impacts on humans, enhanced climate positive feedbacks, which is a warming amplifier. And here you have the 2019-2020 mapping of the accelerated forest fire outbreaks, which are now covering more and more area and caused by human global warming or accentuated by human global warming. Tipping elements are real. It's a real risk that we cannot rule out. The IPCC is clear here. Here you see the trajectory in terms of the risk assessments from science, from the third assessment of the IPCC all the way till today. What you see here is that the more scientific advances, the lower in global mean temperature is the scientific assessment of the risk of crossing tipping points, and that the tipping point risk today is down between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. With low probability, high impact events. We don't have scientific certainty here yet, but we are seeing more and more a risk landscape that is coming very closer within the Paris range. The scientific frontier here is that we are not only seeing the risk of crossing tipping points, but it's also that we are seeing the risk of interactions, so-called cascades, between tipping element systems. And you see here, for example, when the Greenland ice sheet melts fast, releasing cold freshwater in the North Atlantic, slowing down the overturning of heat in the North Atlantic, impacting on the monsoon over the Amazon, which can explain higher degree of droughts and forest fires in the Amazon rainforest, which in turn also locks in warm water in the Southern Ocean, accelerating potentially the melting of the West Antarctic ice shelf. These cascades is on the scientific frontier. We are still working very hard on this, but it just gives even stronger message to negotiators here that precaution is important. Climate action must be just, and this justice factor has very dramatic numbers. We know them all, but just to give you the latest statistics, the richest 1% must reduce emissions by a factor 30, while the poorest 50% in the world can actually increase emissions by a factor 3 for the world to stay within the global carbon budget in a fair way. Now, insight 6 is really on behavioral change. We need to have a transition not only into decarbonization of the energy systems in terms of technologies, but we also need 1.5 degrees Celsius lifestyles. Status quo in consumption patterns and growth will not take us to the Paris range. This is about equity, but it's also about lifestyle change and behavioral change. Insight 7 is about economic policy measures. We have so much scientific evidence today that carbon pricing can accelerate the scale of transition. 61 countries in the world have adopted a price on carbon. This is, however, it's only covering 22% of global emissions are covered by a carbon price, and so far the carbon price is not efficient because it's set at a too low level. But the European Union is the first example in the world of a region where the carbon pricing system is starting to work because it's starting to come up to scientific parity in the level of pricing at over 60 euros per ton of carbon dioxide. Nature-based solutions are absolutely fundamental to have a chance of delivering the Paris Agreement. The challenge, though, is to have robust, resilient nature-based solutions and not to fool ourselves in investing in offsetting mechanisms that have already been factored into the climate models that give us a carbon budget. So, you know, the only reason why we have a remaining carbon budget that allows us to reduce emissions, according to what I mentioned earlier of a net zero world economy by 2050, is that we assume that nature will continue to be a net carbon sink. So we need nature-based solutions, but we cannot use them to slow down the pace of emission reductions from fossil fuel emissions. The ocean is the resilient thermostat of the planet, biologically and physically. We have so much science today showing the threats to the ocean, and we'll come back to that in the discussion here. But this is something that will be also a determinant factor, and investing in 30% targets for marine protected areas, we believe, is one measure to reduce these threats. And finally, number 10 is on the connections between climate impacts and costing, that we need to correct the market economic failure in factoring in the true cost of climate damage, and that the number one entry point there is really about health, that we have today over 7 million people per year being prematurely losing their lives because of air pollutants, which is one of the factors that we need to now fully factor into the costing of our risky journey on climate change. So with that, a rapid overview of the report, you have it.
During that quick roundup of new climate science from the latest Intergovernmental Panel report, you heard Professor Rockström bring up the threat of cascading tipping points. I covered that last week on Radio EcoShock with the lead author from the Potsdam Institute, Dr. Nico Wunderling. Now, you can find that free audio on the show website at ecoshock.org. Go ahead and get that. Later in this program, I alert you to one of the scariest warnings yet for everyone who lives in cities, where more than half of the Earth's population do live. If there's time, I will also dig into why one respectable teacher and climate tweeter wondered if the population of India could be only 200 million people by 2070. That comes from more shocking news released at COP26. On a late evening in Glasgow, in the first week of the conference, let's hear from Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Paul is at the COP getting his daily COVID test. Beckwith set up multiple science briefings in the UN Press Briefing Room for nonprofits.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The Glasgow COP26 Climate Summit is full of reassuring headlines. I know I feel better. The world is renouncing coal, ending deforestation, and going net zero. What a relief. Finally. But look deeper. Are we still investing in the suicide of civilization and mass extinction? Reporting after a long day at the COP in Scotland, we have Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith on the phone. Paul has two master's degrees, taught climate science at universities, and is currently the biggest provider of climate science YouTube videos. He is teaching the world. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
So the world leaders have left. It's still very early in the talks. But how was your day at the circus, Paul?
It was quite a busy day. There are lots to see in the exhibit section. They have different sections. You know, many countries have to talk about various aspects of climate change that concern them. And there's a group where there's just science talks, which I'm spending quite a bit of time at. And there's a whole booth on methane and the, you know, different ways to try to reduce emissions of methane and to emphasize how important methane is as a greenhouse gas, because the focus, of course, is always on carbon dioxide. You know, methane and nitrous oxide and other gases get kind of a short shrift, you know, in terms of addressing climate change. So spent some time there. There's also a very excellent section on the cryosphere where there's lots on the Arctic and Antarctic and lots of talks. And I bumped into Jason Bock, who's one of the eminent scientists on Greenland. He spends most of his time on Greenland studying the ice cap, and Kevin Anderson walked into the room. Of course, he's a well-known British scientist who refuses to fly anywhere. And I was in a presentation just earlier this evening with Regina Valdez and Peter Wadhams and Stephen Salter. And today's topic was marine cloud brightening, pumping seawater through nozzles to generate very, very fine salt crystals, which then act as cloud condensation nuclei to try to brighten clouds over the ocean to, you know, reflect away sunlight and allow some cooling of the oceans below them. It's a very interesting concept and idea. And yesterday's press conference was with Yi Tao, whose his idea is called MEER, M-E-E-R, to reflect away sunlight using arrays of mirrors on the surface of the Earth. So we had some good discussions. And then other press conferences focused kind of on the extreme weather. Well, the topic of one I called extreme weather chaos in our climate casino. You know, the idea that it didn't matter where you were on the Earth, many places were being hit by either torrential rains leading to floods or droughts and people's homes, wildfires, for example. So, you know, your home could go up in smoke, your business, in fact, the entire town or region could be hammered by floods or something. So we're in kind of like a climate casino. And I actually went in a casino to film a video so I could be in a casino within the climate casino to see what that was like. And it turns out that the CO2 level in the casino is lower than outside.
Oh, wow.
Right? So I have a detector which measures CO2, radon, temperature, pressure, relative humidity, and volatile organic compounds, and it connects with Bluetooth to my phone. And wherever I go, whatever I do, it records all of these things pretty much real time. And it's kind of fascinating because I've always thought that in a casino, you know, there's stories of them pumping oxygen in to keep the clientele more alert and awake and allow, you know, lose their money for longer periods of time. And I think they have some sort of CO2 scrubbing because the CO2 level outside is about 450 parts per million in Glasgow, being a northern country and also being in the city. But in the casino, it was 415 somehow. So that was kind of interesting.
Well, the climate in there is going to be better. We could all just move into casinos, I guess, if things get tough. I've seen these presentations you've been doing. They're on YouTube already from the United Nations briefing room, press conferences. Great stuff. It reminds me a bit of the late Stuart Scott, who kind of pioneered that methodology. You two had appeared together, I know, in the past. But you raised something really important just a minute ago. Like, I've had major scientists on this show who say methane doesn't matter. It just disappears out of the atmosphere in 10 or 12 years. It's carbon dioxide all the way that will determine the future. But you've been warning the world about increasing methane for years and years. I don't know how many years, a lot. But it must be head-spinning to see a methane agreement coming out in the last few months as a big action of the COP.
Yeah, I mean, just a few days ago, you know, many countries, there's a major agreement on methane to reduce methane emissions by 30% by 2030. And there was another agreement, which was signed by over 100 countries to stop deforestation. That covers about 80% of the global forests under the agreement to stop deforestation by 2030. So those things are actually quite significant, although people, it's important to remember that in 2014, there was a forestry agreement that was signed by many countries, and it didn't amount to anything. So, you know, taking it with kind of like a grain of salt. But, I mean, it's heading in the right direction. And, you know, hopefully there's lots of other, there's been reports, I think, on financing, you know, putting trillions of dollars into climate change. There's a lot of acknowledgement that it's not just the mitigation, but it's adaptation is important. Before, in the past, sometimes people kind of stayed away from the idea of we need money for adaptation because it was kind of admitting failure to, you know, mitigate climate change. But, I mean, there's so many problems around the world now because of, you know, abrupt climate change that it's really hard for countries to ignore the problem. There was also some agreement on getting out of coal, but I think some of the major countries like India and China and stuff didn't, you know, aren't part of the agreement. So whether that means anything or not is another question. But I think China, I'm not too concerned when there's a country that kind of dragging their feet a bit, because I know that the extreme weather events accelerating around the planet are just going to skyrocket when we lose the Arctic sea ice, and any country that wasn't on board on taking action or being concerned will, you know, if they're not concerned this year, they'll be concerned next year, sort of thing.
Well, I think we really have to take China very seriously. According to the latest figures available, China emitted almost 28% of global greenhouse gases. So more than a quarter of everything that's going up there now is coming through China. But on the other hand, China has 40% of their energy coming from renewables. They are the world's biggest renewable producer as well. But then again, they consume half the world's coal, which is saying a lot. And they promise to continue building new coal plants in their own country. They won't finance them outside, they say, but they're going to keep building up their coal fleet. How much does it matter that China chose not to show up, really, at COP26?
I'm actually very surprised that they didn't show up, that the government, you know, the leader and the main people didn't show up. I mean, they have a big presence here in some of the exhibits and booths, but it's not, you know, it's sort of a lower level people from China. So I think they're doing a lot of talking and negotiating sort of behind the scenes, but I think they're also a bit cynical about these conferences because, you know, Western countries make promise after promise and then it doesn't amount to anything. So I think China is being hammered by climate change, by extreme weather events. They're getting torrential rains in some regions which fill up their rivers and force the movement of millions, literally millions of people, or millions of homes involving even tens of millions of people, you know, being displaced while their towns are flooded. So China is also being hammered. Many of the food-producing regions of China are being hammered also by drought or torrential rains. So, I mean, they're being greatly affected by climate. So, you know, they know what's going on. They know it's important to do things. And they've actually, you know, when Trump was the U.S. president, the U.S. kind of dropped the ball on climate and China kind of took it up for a while. So it's really hard to say because we don't get a lot of info on what China is doing. But I hear from people that they're very concerned and doing things about, you know, they're also trying to balance it with, we've all been through the virus, right, the coronavirus and stuff, and that's affected things. You know, it would have been much better if all the countries had people here, but, you know, maybe they really thought that this would be canceled or something because of the virus. I don't know.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock and the COP26. Our guest is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Well, a lot of people did think that. How do you think the pandemic has affected this COP, and maybe it's time to do the whole COP online and save those 10,000 airplane tickets and all those emissions. So what do you think?
You know, I think the COP will go online at some point, you know, with technology improvements, that eventually, you know, there won't be any need for people to travel to, like, you could be able to do, you know, maybe put on a virtual reality headset, and it's like you're in the conference room with other people from all over the world, right? You see other people as holograms or something, I don't know, or 3D images. And, like, I think, you know, it won't be too far along before the experience of meeting people in real life will be simulated digitally, you know, in a virtual reality environment. And then people really have no need to go other places. I mean, you want to go to a beach, just put on a virtual reality headset and walk around your room and you're on the beach. I mean, maybe they could even pipe in smells of the ocean or something from this digital equipment, right? So I don't know.
Yeah, I think they could do it. I mean, one of the arguments has been, well, look, what really happens at COP happens in the hallways and the offhand chance discussions in a restaurant. But you can create, you know, hangouts and other little clubhouses and things, rooms where people can visit. And certainly the rest of the population, who I think we should have a say and an interest in this, since it's our future, we can participate more and we can certainly see what's going on. I mean, I understand that at this COP, it was organized so late or so badly that people in the outside rooms, in other words, most of the people who went there, can't actually see what's going on inside. They don't have the usual screens broadcasting the actual event.
Yeah, I mean, Madrid was rushed together, if you remember. Like in 2019, the conference was supposed to be in Santiago, Chile. Right. And about 3 weeks before, or a month before it was supposed to start, there was a lot of unrest and protests in the streets. And in fact, the subway system was trashed by the protesters and destroyed, and the government just said, okay, we can't have all these people coming, you know, things are getting out of hand. So they canceled the COP, and then within the next week, there was an offer from Madrid, Spain, and the UN took it up gladly. And so they put together, you know, considering they had such a small amount of time, you know, Madrid, Spain put together a fantastic event. I mean, you know, there were glitches and things, but they had 3 weeks to plan it. So, you know, Scotland's had a lot more time, but then there was a lot of uncertainty as to whether it would even happen. And then there was talk about having no exhibits. And, you know, things were changing sort of on a daily basis. And, like, the press conferences that the NGOs are putting on, they were a few days before we were actually at the airport to fly from Ottawa to Toronto, or maybe it was from Toronto to Amsterdam, and there was an email from the UN, and it said that there would be no NGOs able to give press conferences on the Monday and Tuesday because all of the rooms, world leaders were going to be there, and they needed all of the space and the rooms and for security reasons. And that was a big surprise. It was released at the last minute. So there's things like that going on, but that's a bit par for the course with these UN meetings. You have to be very flexible. Like on the Sunday, I was slated to do the press conference with Regina Valdez and Peter Wadham and myself on the extreme weather chaos in the climate casino. And so we had our scheduled session, and we were in the room early, a couple hours before we were due to go on, and there was a session where people didn't show up. So I went and talked to them, and I organized the session. Just I said, well, you know, rather than just sit in an empty room, let me go on and talk for half an hour, which I did with Regina. So that sort of thing. And today I thought I might get a chance to do the same thing because, you know, the group that puts together one of the temperature records, the Berkeley people, BEST, Berkeley, they have one of the big temperature records. You know, when the global temperature is reported, there's about five different groups that come up with their temperature record, and they report one of them. So, you know, it's a big deal with Berkeley, and they had lots of people. They were supposed to give a press conference two sessions before ours, and they didn't show up. So, you know, I was very surprised because we're, you know, maybe the first day I could see it. I think they must have just got the day wrong. They must have just, there's confusion. They were changing quite a bit because they assigned all the non-governmental organizations press slots. And then after a week later, they had to pull a lot of slots because they determined that they had to spend 15 minutes between the half-hour press conferences to clean the room out, clean all the surfaces for, like, to meet the virus protocols in the UK, in Scotland and stuff. So lots of changes going on, but I haven't heard of any transmission of the virus. I mean, we all do our tests every morning. These antigen tests, which are they're not too bad. You get kind of in a routine and you just do them, and then the results come about 15-20 minutes later, and you confirm it with the National Health Services in Scotland. And I mean, all of the kits in Scotland are free. You know, they encourage people that gather in meetings to test themselves before the meetings, and they provide all of the, they provide 7-day test kits free. And I know in Ontario, to take the antigen test, it was like $40 or something at a pharmacy.
We can't even get them in BC. The British Columbia government was sent, I don't know, over 1 million tests by the federal government, and they just haven't been released, haven't been used. Reporters have been asking for months, where are they? But let's not get off into the pandemic too bad. I do want to go to another really feel-good headline I saw from CNBC. It says, COP26 climate summit continues after landmark deal to ditch coal. Well, that's fantastic, Paul. Did the world leaders agree to ditch coal, as the UK host organizer and the prime minister had kind of promised?
Well, you know more than me on that one, because going around the conference and stuff, I didn't hear any or see anything about that. You know, if it went across the news, it was probably negotiated in some back room with the British. I mean, maybe the British government was trying to push it or.
Okay. Well, here's my take on that, and that's that. The leaders agreed of some countries. Of course, China wasn't there. Various countries didn't take part in it. Russia, on and on. So they haven't agreed to ditch coal at all. But the leaders agreed to eventually stop financing external coal facilities so that if you're in the UK, you won't finance a new coal plant in Morocco or something like that. It didn't amount to a lot of money. It was several billion dollars, but not trillions by any means. And, of course, all the countries are just going to go ahead and use the coal with no limitation within their own boundaries. So China will increase their coal use and other countries will increase their coal use. So, no, they didn't ditch coal. They just, you know, made a promise to stop pushing it with our taxpayers' money on other countries. That's as far as we got. So, have you seen any Australians there or heard anything about them?
I have seen some Australians. I've seen some First Nations people from Northern Australia, and they attended the Sunday press conferences, and I spoke with, it was three women who came, and their region is being harmed by fracking. Fracking has taken off big time in their part of Australia, it's in Northern Australia. I don't know the exact region, but, you know, they said, can you please do something? Like, they've watched my videos and so on. Can I, they asked if I could do a video on all aspects of fracking, chemicals used, how harmful it was, once the fracking well, they don't last very long. So you drill a hole in the ground, you get the natural gas, the methane coming up, and then within a year or two, the flow of methane drops right off, and you close it down, and you go drill a hole somewhere else. So, and then, but countries are not forcing companies to close the wells properly, so there's often leaks, residual leaks of methane from them, and so on. I mean, there's numerous of wells like this in many states in the U.S. and also out in Alberta, and it's happening now in regions of northern Australia. So, this was all started, if you remember, by government claims that methane, or they didn't say methane, they said natural gas would act as a bridge fuel between the, present fossil fuel industry, this was a few years ago, and total renewables, right? And, of course, it turned into a whole industry on its own and was responsible partly for a great increase of methane concentrations in the atmosphere, right? And, it looks to me like the next big push by industries, by fossil fuel companies, will be to push for a hydrogen economy, because then they can use the fossil fuels to break down chemically, to not burn them, but break them down chemically to extract hydrogen to fuel a hydrogen economy. But, hydrogen is really just a storage mechanism for energy, right? It's not a fuel per se. It's more like an intermediate step. So, but it would be another sort of thing that would, allow the fossil fuel companies to exist, but, push their business to mining the fossil fuels for chemically breaking them down instead of burning them to produce the hydrogen and so on. So at least it would allow fossil fuels to still have, like oil and natural gas and stuff, to still have a value in producing hydrogen, but then you have to look at the whole energy. How much energy does it take to break the fossil fuels, say methane, whatever, break the hydrogens off?
I don't put much faith in that, but I don't have the expertise to make a final judgment. But I do want to bring listeners up to speed on this new plan that they call the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, or GFANZ. And it's partly led by the former governor of the Bank of Canada and then the Bank of England, Mark Carney, a Canadian guy, so to speak. And they say that by 2050, all the assets managed by the world's largest banks and investment companies, no doubt they won't include the Chinese or Russian, will be net zero emissions. But there's just super problems with that. And one of the biggest ones, and the most dangerous in my opinion, is that it absolutely counts on carbon offsets. They're going to continue emissions-heavy projects, but they'll claim a forest somewhere else is being saved. And it sort of reminds me of those gangster movies in New York where somebody comes into a restaurant and says, well, it's a very nice restaurant you got here. It'd be a shame if something were to happen to it. You can kind of say the same thing about your national forests, which you should be saving because you want to save the climate. But instead, you market them off to international companies who can now say they're net zero even though they're producing fossil fuels or products made from them. I just worry to death about this carbon offset. It's kind of a big, big scam.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to use that word to, it just sounds like a big scam, as you say. The backroom deals and then the markets for the offsets. I mean, if trees are used for offsetting it, look what's happening with all the trees in the Northern Hemisphere, the wildfires. As bad as the wildfires are right now, it's only a tiny percentage, fraction of a percent of the area of trees that is burning. And, look at all the effects of all the smoke and, disruption. We're getting heat waves in forest areas. They're getting as dry as tinder and just going up. Look at Lytton in BC, right? 49.6 degrees Celsius on the third day of the heat wave. It was over 49, 48. For 3 days in a row, and then the spark and the town burned down the next day. So, putting all of these offsets into forests making, you know, sure, growing all the trees. What happens when there's a drought in the area? The trees all dry out, and now there's more and more vegetation that can burn. You know, wait till in a world that's a degree or 2 degrees warmer than now, how are we going to have any offsets in trees? You know, many of those trees will go up in smoke, not entire forests.
If you say, okay, we're going to save all the forests we've got right now, we're going to stop deforestation, where do the emissions cuts come from if you just go ahead and do all your industrial projects with fossil fuels and say, well, the forests have got me covered?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I had an hour in tomorrow's presentation on ocean pasture restoration. Russ George, he's not here, but we filmed about 3 minutes. You know, and we'll be talking all about the idea of using plankton in the ocean to capture carbon and also to replenish the marine life. Because, you know, if you add a lot of phytoplankton at the bottom of the food chain, then you get proliferation of marine life all the way up the food chain. So how to make, you know, areas of the ocean that are basically deserts, if you like, to for life. I mean, how to use them to produce. Like according to Russ George, since 1950, we've lost about 50% of the plankton in the ocean. That's what he was telling me. I spoke with him for about an hour after he did the short video clips filming. You know, I was talking him more about the scientific details of, you know, the whole concept. And, you know, he was saying that the amount of iron in the open ocean is only about 3 parts per trillion. If you're near a coastline, it's more like 3 parts per million, because there's lots of sources of iron from dust blowing off the land and from dirt being carried in rivers, and that's all got iron in it and stuff. So when there's a lot of phosphates and nutrients like fertilizer going down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico, you get these phytoplankton blooms in the very shallow water, and of course that causes a deoxygenation of the water, which is very bad. But, you know, in the ocean, iron in the middle deep ocean is a completely different ball game, because you need very little of it, and it's a missing nutrient, and then you can get phytoplankton blooms there. And, you know, any dead plant material, or if it's ingested by, eaten by zooplankton, and then goes up the food chain and then it's excreted out, that sinks very quickly to the deep ocean. But there's very little oxygen at the bottom of the deep ocean. It's pretty much an anoxic to begin with, so it's not going to be worsened significantly by phytoplankton blooms at the surface. All that carbon matter will be dispersed widely by ocean currents on the way down, you know, spread out, but it also goes into a region that's already anoxic. So it's a totally different ballgame. It's very, very promising technique, and we'll be talking about it in tomorrow's session. So I'm trying to do many different press conferences on some of the, you know, what I think are some of the most promising ways to pull carbon out of the atmosphere or cause some cooling, you know, with the marine cloud brightening and or the mirrors, reflection.
We just had Rob Jackson on talking about methane removal using zeolites and possibly these sky towers. He was on a couple of weeks ago talking about that.
There was a session just before my session today. There was a whole session on methane, and it involved removal methods. Like, one of them is iron salt aerosols. Another one was the zeolite. Another one was introducing methanotrophic bacteria into, actually into the ground, the thawing permafrost regions, and it chemically reacts and breaks down a lot of the methane before it can go up to the atmosphere. So there's all of these different possible ideas, and people are recognizing this might be, you know, one of the easiest, like it might be a lot easier to do it because methane, you know, has a shorter lifetime than CO2, and it reacts. It's easier to break it down than CO2. So it might be the thing to focus on to cut immediate warming.
Well, I did a whole show on that, and listeners can make up their minds on that. I would caution you that I feel that Russ George lost some credibility here in BC for various reasons. I did a whole program on that. But I do feel there is promise in either the sea pasture idea or developing seagrass forests, which can get a lot more carbon dioxide out of the air. So there are things we can do with the ocean, and the ocean covers so much of the Earth's surface. We've definitely got to look into that. It must have been gratifying, Paul, to see a permafrost day at COP. That's certainly a first-time debut for that. Do you still believe what happens in the Arctic could determine the fate of civilization and more?
You know, you could probably remember Peter Wadhams did a paper with an economist a few years ago, and they modeled a release of 50 gigatons of methane in the Arctic, and either coming up all in 1 year or coming up, say, 5 gigatons a year over a decade. And it turned out from their research that both things would of course be, you know, very bad for humanity. And I think they found out that the floor release over time would actually be worse. We have to remember, when we talk about a methane release, something quick to us would be, say, in a few months or a year, whereas if something took a decade, it wouldn't be considered as such a fast process. But if you bring it back to geological timescales, of course, 10 years is nothing, right? So it's hard for me to imagine that, like, 50 gigatons of methane would come up in a year from the Arctic, say, because if you think of how it would happen, say, on the eastern Siberian Arctic shelf, I mean, you're getting a thawing of the cap layer, which is keeping the methane down. And then on land, anyway, we're getting these methane outbursts, which is leaving a big crater behind, right, in Siberia on the land. And then under the ocean, there's large pock marks in various places where there was large methane releases, but you'd have to have, like, for there to be a sudden outburst of methane where the methane breaks through the surface, it would do it in a sort of a region. And, you know, as more and more methane came out, it would maybe widen the opening over which it was coming out. But globally, it wouldn't have a global effect. It would be multiple perforations over this vast continental shelf that would all add together. And that would take time. I think that would, you know, probably take more. I think the 10-year scenario where we have, say, 5 gigatons coming out a year would be the more likely scenario. And if you look at some of the work that Peter Fiakowski is doing with climate restoration, I mean, this is one of their, I think they started a group on methane oxidation. Like, how would you, if such a burst occurred in the Arctic, what would we do? Could we do anything about it? And there's a number of interesting ideas that are coming along. I mean, the Healthy Climate Alliance and their work on methane oxidation is worth looking at. I'm not saying we know how to stop it now, but there's some interesting ideas coming, and it looks like there's more funding that might come available, especially with this announcement of reduction of 30% in the next 10 years. I mean, how are they proposing to do that? Like, I didn't see any, you know, you have to look at the sources. I think they're proposing a reduction of the emissions just by changing in the industry that is producing it, like fossil fuel industry. A lot of it coming from, you know, when you bring oil to the surface, you know, you're bringing it from a high pressure region deep in the ground to atmospheric pressure, and there's gases trapped in. Often methane is released from an oil well, and, you know, it has to be flared off, or it's, you know, if the oil well is isolated, there's no way to transport that methane. So often it's just flared off at the stack, or even worse, just let into the atmosphere. There's more and more methane from wetlands, and there's also a lot coming from dump, where we dump our garbage, landfill, please. There's a lot of methane coming from that, too. Most of the reductions that these countries are promising is from reducing those sources as opposed to dealing with it in the atmosphere. It seems it'll be a lot easier to get funding to do some of these projects that the climate restoration people and other people are thinking of with this announcement at the COP.
So when COP26 ends, what will you be watching for as a signal our kids might have a decent chance?
The biggest thing, I think, is pretty obvious, and that was it 2009 when many countries promised to eliminate subsidies on fossil fuels. Nothing close to that has happened. Subsidies to fossil fuels has actually actually increased. And Peter Carter showed we had a couple 3-minute clips from him from last Sunday's press conference. And one of them, he showed the fossil fuel subsidies. And I think it's from the International Energy Agency, and it divides fossil fuel subsidies into direct subsidies and indirect. And there's a lot more indirect than direct. And the direct ones show a slight decrease over the next 4 or 5 years, and the indirect ones are still increasing. So unless there's actually discussion at this COP and movement on eliminating subsidies on fossil fuels, then, you know, it's no good. It's a failure. That's the most important thing. You know, if countries agreed to get rid of subsidies and gave a time frame, say over the next few years or even 5 years, and, you know, you have to go down 20% next year, 30% the year after, et cetera, until there's no subsidies, that's what we need. So until we see that, all of these other things are blah, blah, blah.
From COP26 in Glasgow, Scotland, our guest is climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Look for his fabulous YouTube channel and his website at paulbeckwith.net. Paul, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's always great talking with you.
Thank you, and, you know, we'll talk again soon.
Like the majority of people on this planet, most of you live in cities. That's why you need to tune in to a new report from the United Nations released November 3rd at COP26. The title is Beating the Heat, a Sustainable Cooling Handbook for Cities. But listen to this, and I'm going to read you a bit from the introduction to that handbook. Quote, "The world's cities are heating up at twice the global average rate due to rapid urbanization and the urban heat island effect. By 2100, cities across the world could warm as much as 4.4 degrees Celsius on average, more than double the Paris Agreement's goal of limiting global temperature rise to no more than 1.5 degrees C. Hotter cities could be catastrophic for public health. If the current trends in urbanization and increasing heat continue, it is expected that the urban population exposed to high temperatures, that is, average summertime highs above 35 degrees C, will increase 800% to reach 1.6 billion people by mid-century." End quote. This Sustainable Cooling Handbook for Cities report continues, quote, "The challenge is compounded by the fact that the impacts of urban heat are not evenly distributed. Lower-income districts within a city are often hotspots due to a lack of green spaces and to the co-location of industrial operations. And residents of these areas are also less likely to be able to afford or access cooling for thermal comfort. These communities are usually the most vulnerable to heat, disproportionately bearing the negative impacts of excess warming. In the absence of focused policy and market-based interventions, market behavior defaults to an increasing number of people relying on air conditioners to address rising heat. Already, 2.3 billion people in the increasingly affluent lower middle class in developing countries are on the verge of purchasing an entry-level air conditioner, typically the unit that is the most affordable and likely the least efficient on the market. This can be a quick and localized fix for those who can afford it, but it comes with severe consequences, where the emissions and waste heat from cooling perpetrate a vicious cycle where mechanical cooling is further warming our cities, necessitating even more cooling and further compounding the equity divide for those who are unable to afford access. So, it is a feedback loop coming from people trying to stay alive with air conditioners." That is my reading from the executive summary to the Sustainable Cooling Handbook for Cities. In addition to UNEP, the report comes from the COOL Coalition, RMI, which is the Rocky Mountain Institute, the Global Covenant of Mayors for Climate and Energy, GCOM, Mission Innovation and Clean Cooling Collaborative. The handbook shows pathways that can reduce urban heat up to 4 degrees C. The solutions come mainly from city governments. The report gives examples of reclaiming a river in Seoul, South Korea, to the largest urban cooling system in the world, which is in Toronto, Canada, where cool water from the bottom of Lake Ontario cools commercial buildings. The handbook finds central cooling systems are the best answer compared to a million little inefficient AC units that blow more hot air into the streets. Central cooling was built into the Pearl River New City project in Guangzhou, China. One of the best discussions on how cities survive extreme heat comes from Dr. Matt Santamouris in my Radio EcoShock show broadcast February 1st, 2018, and again just a couple of weeks ago. Find that free at ecoshock.org. I think that's enough and all we can stand for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for working to understand the real climate challenge and listening to Radio EcoShock.